Venerable Sangha, good friends in the Dharma.
When in reverence this truth is heard, even once, he who praises it and gladly embraces it has merit without end. How much more he who turns within and confirms directly his own nature, so that his own nature is no nature. Such has transcended vain words. The gate opens, and cause and effect are one. Straight runs the way, not two, not three, taking as form the form of no form. Going or returning, he is ever at home. Taking as thought, the thought of no thought. Singing and dancing, all is the voice of truth. So we continue on with Song of Meditation by Hakuin, Hakuin Ekaku. When in reverence this truth is heard even once, he who praises it and gladly embraces it has merit without end. And we've heard something already about this reverence last night from Venerable Sogen. If we remember the story of the rabbi and his student, and the student who asks, why is it that nowadays no one ever sees the countenance of the Lord, whereas in the past it was not so rare? And the rabbi replied, because these days no one can stoop so low. And that stooping so low has to very much do with that reverence, because the term reverence is an attitude, a sense of faith of something that is superior to myself, a judgment and the acknowledgement of that superiority. And this is an attitude that is, I think it's fair to say, is not popular these days. We don't like it. In fact, we're very distrustful of it. And the thing is, to be quite frank and straightforward about this, is that unless we can allow some reverence in our heart, unless we actually can trust something other than just myself, then Buddhism cannot help us at all. In the Pali Canon, it was not an uncommon event that the Buddha would talk to a large group of people and they would all become enlightened, just like that. They would hear the Four Noble Truths, or the Noble Eightfold Path, or the Skandhas or Dhatus or something, and it would end up with them saying that such and such, or this group of people, or this person who asked the question, suddenly became liberated, or suddenly attained nirvana, or suddenly became enlightened. And, you know, one looks at this and sort of thinks, God, could it really have been so easy then? Because, you know, here we are, we're well over halfway through our week now, a little bit more, and we've been hearing, probably discovering, that these teachings have been told to us, and we've been hearing them more than once. And I'm quite sure 90% of you, no, probably more, 95% of you, are realizing that actually we're not saying anything new. Many of you have been here on previous years, so you've heard these talks before. Quite a number of you I've seen at the society in various classes, so I know you've been listening to talks on the Buddha Dharma. None of this is new, and certainly as far as the stories that I certainly put my own hand up, the stories that I tell are, well, it's a limited few. They get recycled again and again and again. You keep coming back, very grateful for it. But, you know, none of this is new. And yet no one's ever come up and sort of said, that's it, I'm enlightened. You won't be seeing me next year. No, we keep coming back. Why is that? The Buddha gave us everything we needed. And not only do we have the Pali Canon, we have the Mahayana as well, all those teachings as well. So, yes, we know that the different teachings accord with different levels of understanding and capability and so on. Well, traditionally it's said that there are 84,000 teachings, and whilst not all of those 84,000 teachings have all been translated into English, quite a few have, and yet despite that, we don't suddenly become enlightened on hearing it. that realization doesn't sort of come straight in. Why is that? Why is that? What is wrong with our attitude? What is it, or perhaps, no, perhaps it would be better to say, instead of talking about wrong, what is different about our attitude to those who were listening to the Buddha? And we may think, perhaps, well, perhaps the Buddha has a supernormal powers. After all, it was said that the Buddha did have supernormal powers. Maybe he was able to do something to facilitate the understanding of the hearers. But actually, this is denied because in the sutras it says that Buddhas do but point the way. They cannot actually make us understand. They couldn't make their hearers understand by some kind of magic power. So it was actually the capability of the hearers. It was all in the hearers. It wasn't in the Buddhas. And of course, for us, this translates to this sort of round of going from one class to another class, to another book, to another course, to another lecture, because we think, maybe if I hear it slightly differently, maybe if I hear it in a Theravadan way, or a Zen way, or a Tibetan Nyingma way, rather than a Kagyu way, or something like that, maybe then it will all click in. In other words, we always put the emphasis on the understanding, the catalyst for the understanding, being something outside of ourselves, rather than actually our own hearts. And this is really where that importance of reverence comes in, because actually, as we heard last night, that empty heart. Well, right, again, that analogy, if you want to put something in this cup, well, you can put something in this cup because it's empty. There's nothing in it. But if it's full, then you couldn't put anything more into it. It's a very old analogy, that one, but it's always true. And usually when we hear things, we're listening to the wrong thing. We are easily distracted. We like spectacle. We like something fantastic. And the ordinary, and sometimes the Buddha's teachings, after you've read them a few times, well, they do become a bit ordinary, really. And so we go searching for some kind of specialness that is going to really finally make me understand. And there's an anecdote from the French Tibetan Buddhist and explorer Alexandra David Neal. And she underwent a training in Tibetan Buddhism under several lamas and went through the whole process. And she wanted, because she knew perfectly well that people were very interested in Buddhism in the West, she wanted to bring them West. But some of the teachings that she had been given were regarded as highly secret and were only given to those who had received initiation. And when she talked to her guru, to her lama, about this, she said, you know, I'd like to write a book or two. And he said, that's fine. And she said, well, I'd also like to write about the secret oral teachings as well, please. And but, you know, do you think that would be all right? And he laughed and said, my dear, he said, I've not been to the West, he said, but I've traveled extensively in Tibet, in China, and in India. And everywhere I go, people are pretty much the same. What they're interested in is tales of marvels and wonder, grand spectacles, great theatre. As for the secret oral teachings, my dear, you can shout them from the rooftops. No one will listen to them. Well, if you're interested, you can go to the Buddhist Society and you can get her book, which is called, because she wrote it, she did write the book, The Secret Teachings, The Secret Oral Teachings of the Tibetan Masters. And there you can read all about what those secret teachings are. Do you want to know what they are? The 12-link chain of arising due to condition, rebirth, the skandhas and dhatus, the Four Noble Truths, the Three Signs of Being, yes, they're all there, those secret oral teachings. They're not secret because no one will tell them to us. They're secret because, well, we're blind to them. We don't see them. Why don't we see them? Because I'm too full of my own understanding. I'm too full of my own way of seeing things to really understand Buddhism. Actually, first of all, we have to empty everything out. It's a common human trait to try to understand something new in terms and in the categories of things that we already know. And the problem with Buddhism is, and particularly for us in the West, is that actually it comes from a completely different culture. So it's not even our native culture. It's not even our native mindset. So we have added difficulty when coming to it. We don't even have that sort of inculcated native feeling for it that creates such a difference. We used to at least have more of it than we do now. But nowadays, we're pretty much irreligious. In fact, religion is a dirty word. Spirituality is all right. You can get away with that. You see spirituality quite often on the bookshelves in places like Waterstones, etc., and they have lots of books. But books on religion are usually much less. They're usually considerably more academic, and they're not there to be practiced. Spirituality is there to be practiced, but religion not so much. And that is because for various historical reasons, and there are various historical reasons, we don't trust them. We don't trust them. And this creates a real difficulty for us because, as I've already pointed out, without that sense of reverence, which is a sense of religiosity, without that sense of reverence, actually we cannot do this practice. Why? Because when it comes to it, we've been talking about daily life practice, giving myself wholeheartedly into what at this moment is being done. And do we remember the talk that was given by Dr. Chakrabarty when he told the story of the three coins, the three copper coins that he held back and he wouldn't give them? And he explained that this is in fact what we do with the practice as well. That we'll give, yes, we'll give up to a point, but then no more, no more. And then we think, we know that we're not giving. And we think that we're not giving because we don't understand how to give ourselves. But actually, we do know how to give. And we're perfectly capable of giving ourselves, even wholeheartedly, and we do. As long as it's something that I like, as long as it's something that I already trust, as long as we also give ourselves if it's an emergency, or I regard it, or I judge it as something very important, then I will quite naturally give myself to it. Think about, for example, like a parent who has to get up a new mother, a new father, who has to get up three times during the night in order to feed the baby. I mean, if I said to you, okay, just as a practice, get up three times during the night, we might even go, oh, yes. But how long do you think we'd be able to do it for? 6 months? A year? But if you're a mother with a child, well, there's no question of it. I mean, it just doesn't enter your head that you're not going to get up and go and attend to your crying baby. Even though I might say to myself, oh, I couldn't do that. Oh, I couldn't bear to do that. We always say, oh, I couldn't bear to do that. We always think we haven't got the power. We always think we haven't got the strength. But then the situation, the circumstances demands it of us. And then suddenly we find that the power's there. That old story of Master Bankei, who was approached by the old man who asked to become his student. And Master Bankei said, why do you want to become my student? And he said, because I want that special confidence. Confidence is just another word for strength. I want that special confidence to face death, which obviously I'm approaching. And Master Bankei replied, no special confidence is needed to face death. When the time comes to die, you just die. Now, it sounds almost facetious, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like one of those cocky Zen answers, really. And it sounds rather uncaring, but it's not. We mistake. Actually, what Bankei was saying was, your problem is not that you don't have the strength to face death. Of course you do. You were born with it. The problem is that you don't believe you have it. is your lack of faith that you suffer from, not a lack of strength. It's not confidence you need. It's the faith, actually, the real faith, to be able to hand yourself over into that faith, and that faith will carry you. You remember the story of the leper sculptor yesterday. Again, it comes back to that point. And I remember many times, not just myself, but many other people used to go and see Venerable Myo Kyo Ni and say, oh, I've got this problem, or oh, I've got that problem. What should I do? Oh, I've got this, face this situation, or that person. What should I do? And she would always say exactly the same thing. She would always say, give yourself into the practice. Just give yourself. And we'd always say, yeah, I knew you were going to say that. But we sort of secretly always hoped that she would say something else. And sometimes she did, actually. But usually it came back to just give yourself into the practice. Because what she used to say was, if you give yourself into the practice will liberate you. That was the whole point of that leper sculptor story. The more we give out, I can't help myself. I cannot redeem myself, because otherwise I would, and then I wouldn't have a problem. But I do have problems, which means that I'm stumped. I've run into a brick wall for whatever reason, and I don't know what to do. So something now, I have to give myself to something. And unless we have that feeling of reverence, then that trust and that faith will not be there. Now, faith, real religious faith, is not the same as just blind belief. It's not anything to do with blind belief. And I cannot ginger up faith as an act of will. It's actually something that has to be built over time. It's built by trust. And if you think, for example, about how do we go about establishing trust, say, in a friend, you know, in a new friend, we meet somebody. How do we know we can trust them? We don't at first. I mean, we're willing to give them a, you know, benefit of the doubt, perhaps, but, you know, I wouldn't put my life in their hands, necessarily. Not without testing them. And this is really what a relationship is about. We develop a relationship, and little bit by little bit, we begin to, as it were, test them. And if they pass the test, if they come up trumps, then quite naturally, that trust is developing, is being cultivated. And we have to do the same thing with the practice as well. And this is something really, this now leads us on to something else, because this is where that reverence also requires a thoroughness as well. It's not enough just to be fair weather Buddhist practitioners. It's something that we have to do all the time, or as much as we possibly can, whenever we remember. Because otherwise, our practice becomes very patchy indeed. And we don't actually develop the trust in it. Because the only reason that we really don't do this practice, the only reason we don't give ourselves wholeheartedly, is because we don't really believe in it. We do know how to give ourselves. We've always known how to give ourselves. We do give ourselves, as I've already said, when we want to, when we feel it's important or urgent. But if we don't feel it's important or urgent, if I don't judge it as something important or urgent, then I don't give myself to it. And when there's a problem comes, what do I take refuge in? The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha? No. Usually I take refuge in my, first of all, in my own ability to be able to solve the problem. And if I can't, then I worry about it. But always it's about, how do I solve this problem? And this is, again, when we used to go to our teacher, and she would say, just give yourself wholeheartedly into what at this moment is being done. Just give yourself into the daily life practice, please. Just keep on going, and the heart, and then that will liberate you. Yes, yes, we would say, paying lip service, but we didn't believe her. Not really. Maybe a bit. It takes a long time to really forge that faith. But when that faith is 100%, then we finally give ourselves. And then the problem's over, and there are no more problems. So actually, our practice is we could say, it's a problem of faith. It's a problem of how we develop faith, how we develop trust in our own heart. This heart, which is from beginningless time. And this is what is being referred to in this particular section here about our own nature. Because another way of saying our own heart is Buddha nature. When in reverence this truth is heard even once, he who praises it and gladly embraces it has merit without end. In anything that we do, in any undertaking that we wish to pursue, sooner or later, we're going to come across some aspect of it, some facet that I don't like. And this is the real test then. This is where there's a chance for that faith to be developed, for that trust actually to be forged. If there's too much of I in the situation, then that faith won't be trusted. I won't give myself away into it. And the problem is, with this delusion of I, is, as someone once said to Myokyo Ni, you know, when it comes to it, I just can't help it. I know I'm the hub and centre of the whole universe. And actually, when it comes to it, that is, she was just being very honest. But actually, although we more politely may not say so, there is a feeling inside us that's very akin to that. And depending on the strength of that feeling, well, I just won't do it. I just won't. And I remember Myokyo Ni giving an example that she said, there was a gentleman who used to come, or who once came to one of her lectures at the Buddhist Society. And he was very taken with what she said, and very inspired, and decided that he wanted to come along to one of the monthly out-of-town meetings that she used to hold. And in the monthly out-of-town meetings, they're different. They're not lectures. They take place in the Zendo. And to go into the Zendo, a little bit like, the Zendo is just the meditation hall. To go in there, it required the person to bow at the threshold, like we do going into the meditation hall. But this gentleman came up to her and said, I'm sorry. He said, I can't bow. I cannot bow. I'm very sorry. And she said, why? And she said, I don't like the whole thing. I just won't do it. And she turned to him and said to him, well, I'm very sorry, but in that case, you can't come in. And he looked at her and said, are you serious? And she said, yes, I am serious. And he was astounded, but she wasn't, she had said, and that was it, and he went. And she said that whenever she gave a public talk, i.e. in a lecture format, where you didn't have to bow to come into the room, he always came in to listen to her talk. But he never came to anything where he had to bow to come into the room. This is what is meant by that reverence or that trust, that there, sooner or later, I'm going to come up against something that I don't like. And perhaps I really don't like it. And if there's too much I on it, then it becomes the obstacle. That is the obstacle. And the obstacle for him, he thought the problem to solve was simply not having to bow. But that doesn't overcome the problem, because actually it's what produced that not liking, that not wanting, that I won't. That's the obstacle. That's where the attachment is. That's the cause of suffering. Not Myokyo Ni. Myokyo Ni just represents life, like birth and death. It's just a fact of life, a force of the universe that's there. Other people are just facts of life. I always like that quote from the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who said, every problem has a solution. If a problem doesn't have a solution, then it's not actually a problem, it's just a fact of life. And it's a question of, well, when two people meet at a crossroads, sooner or later, one of them must give way. And in the practice, it's not to let the practice be the one that gives way to I. In the end, it has to be that stiff-necked I that is prepared to bend a little bit. Because that stiff-necked I, that is the attachment to I that is spoken about in the Four Noble Truths as the cause of suffering. And so, those little rules that we talked about, whether it's going into the Zendo, or whether it's the bowing, or whether it's the timetable, which we've talked about a little bit, the form. This is the form of how things are done, and everything has a form. And actually, all living creatures have a form. These flowers have a form. They have a season. They have conditions that bring them about. They have a certain colour. And animals also have it. You know, you look at a wolf, it runs. A cat runs. A horse runs. But none of them run in exactly the same way. But a cat's have a way of running that's very identifiable. They run in the way cats run, and wolves run in the way that wolves run, and so on. We also have a nature as well. We have an individual nature, but we also have a collective nature too. And sometimes certain situations, certain circumstances allow us to express our individual nature, and sometimes circumstances allow us to express our collective nature. And I remember once, because being left-handed, going to Shobuan for a meal, quite often if there were a lot of us sat around the dining room table, we would be having a plate of rice or something, and we just had to eat with a fork. We just have a fork, there'd be no knife. And most people pick the fork up in their right hand. Well, I picked it up in my left hand, you see. And so I was asked to transfer it over from my left to my right hand, which I did. But it's much more awkward, of course. And there is that little feeling, isn't it? You know, it's not fair. It shouldn't be. And it's how easy it is to really make something grand and great, and the great oppression sort of out of it, all to do with which hand I'm actually holding my fork in. No one had said to me that I shall go to hell if I, from now on, eat with my left hand, or that I cannot belong to a Buddhist group if I refuse to eat with my right hand, or anything like that. It was just, for this circumstance, please, can you do this? And there was actually, once stopping to look, could see why. We were very closely packed together. And if I eat with my left hand, then the person who's eating with their right hand here, we jostle elbows. And we knock each other. So if we all eat with our right hand, we all have space to do so. It suits the circumstances. And this is now how we learn. This is now how we begin to adapt to the form of things. It's not how I want to do things. It's what the circumstances ask us to do. Just shifting it that little way, that little bit, instead of what I want to do, I want to eat with my left hand because I am left-handed. It's what do these circumstances allow me to do? And remarkably, what it calls out of us is all that creativity we've been hearing about, because suddenly now we find that we have the strength and the creativity and the ability to adapt to those circumstances. And actually, it can be, once I stop moaning to myself about how unfair it is, it's fun. It's a bit of a challenge, actually. It can be great fun learning how to adapt to. It's like problem solving, you know? You don't need to get books on Sudoku or something. Life has plenty of problems. And it's just a matter of really emptying out the heart, looking and seeing, and then responding to what the circumstances, not what I want. And this is where that I is the fly in the ointment. Because if I'm too hung up on what I want, then it obliterates the circumstances. It obliterates the situation, and it cannot be seen. What causes that? Why is it that I get so hung up on what I want, instead of emptying the heart out and just responding to the situation? Well, this is where those passions come in. And this is, of course, where I am too. And I always tell this. I seem to be telling this story every year. I think this is the third year I've told it. I'll try to think of another one, but I just can't think of a better one that really sort of suits it. And this is the old Grimm's fairy tale about the sparrow, the sausage, and the mouse, who all lived together in their little house. And they each had their own particular jobs to do. And the mouse used to chop wood and to keep the fire burning. And the sausage was the cook. And the sparrow was responsible for collecting the water from the well in the forest. And one day, it had been a bit like it was earlier. It was lashing it down, and it was rather cold. as well. It was late autumn. And the sparrow was struggling through the rain and the wind with a bucket between its beak, and managed to get to the well and was got its water and was just putting it in its beak to fly back to the house when another he saw another sparrow who was sitting on a branch nearby, and they said hello to each other. And the sparrow said, "What on earth are you doing in this weather?" And he said, "Well, I'm getting the water for the house. It's my job." And he explained that they each had their own particular job to do. And this other sparrow said, "Well, they saw you coming." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, the mouse, all he has to do is chop a bit of wood and put it on the fire and then sits on the chair with his feet up by the fire. The cook never has to leave the warm kitchen. And here are you out in all weathers. You've really got the short straw, haven't you?" And the sparrow, first of all, defended his friend, saying, "No, we all do our bit. But you know how it is when somebody sort of appeals to our sense of hurt and injury. We all have a little. I always have a feeling that somehow I'm slightly put upon." And as he flew back, he went on in his mind, and he began to go through all those little things from the past, you know, all those little time, all those little injuries from the past, the word, the hurtful word or whatever it was from long ago. And by the time he got home, he had his own mosaic, and it wasn't a pretty one. And he walked in and said to his compatriots, "We must have a house meeting now." And they said, "Oh my goodness, what's happened?" And he sat down and he says, "It's unfair that I should have to go out in all weathers to get the water." He said, "We should rotate the jobs, that's fairer." And his two compatriots said, "No, please, please don't do that." "Ha," he said, "I thought you'd say that. And it just confirms my suspicion." He said, no, we're so well, it's not that, we're so well suited to our own jobs, for who we are, that it doesn't augur well to move things around." But the sparrow was absolutely adamant that things were going to have to change. And finally, his two housemates decided that they had no choice. And so it was agreed that they would all do a different job. And so that now the mouse became the cook, and the sparrow was going to chop the wood and maintain the fire, and the sausage was going to fetch the water. And so the following day, they began with their new jobs, and the mouse put the big pot on and put the water on and began to put the ingredients in and got it up to boil. And the sparrow chopped the wood and then put it onto the fire and then sat down next to it. And the sausage, he went to get the water, and he got to the well, and he put the bucket on the rope and lowered it down, brought it up. But as he grabbed hold of the bucket, his hands being always slightly greasy, being a sausage, it slipped through his hands and fell into the well. So the sausage sort of leaned down into the well, tried to get hold of the bucket handle, and managed, because of the grease, to slip right in and drowned. Meanwhile, back at the cottage, Mouse was there, and the lunch was just now coming to the boil. It was all just about cooked. And he had often seen Sausage lift himself up and dip himself into the stew just to flavour it a little bit. And so he lifted his rear end up and plonked himself down, and of course, like this, and the shock caused him to let go, and he fell into the soup and drowned. The sparrow, who had just nipped outside to fetch a little bit more wood for the fire, and was just beginning to wonder where on earth Sausage could be taking so much time to come back, went and decided that he would go and have a look. And so he went to the well and looked down, and there he saw Sausage floating lifeless on the surface of the well. In horror, growing realization of what he had done, rushed back to tell Mouse, only to see Mouse now cooking in the soup pot, sat down, cried and cried until his heart broke. And it all goes to show what a terrible tragedy all that can make, because I will interfere with things when they don't suit me. Yes, what a tragedy. But this is what I do. I do interfere with things that often work perfectly well because it suits me. Really, why do I do it? Because I get bored, because I want a bit of excitement, because of this, because of that, because I want this, because I want that. In other words, the change is brought about because I want it. It pays no regard to the circumstances, whether the circumstances want it or not. So a useful thing perhaps to really take to heart in our practice. Not what I want, but what the circumstances call for, and to respond in kind to those. He who praises it and gladly embraces it has merit without end. And how much more he who turns within and confirms directly his own nature, that his own nature is no nature, such has transcended vain words. Confirms how much more he who turns within. This looking within, this is coming to the heart of the practice, this looking within and this insight. And in fact reflects a verse that has been attributed to the Indian patriarch, first Chinese patriarch as well, Bodhidharma, when he said a special transmission outside the teachings, not dependent on words and phrases, directly pointing to the human heart, seeing into its nature and awakening. And we remember that Buddha means the one who is awake. So awakening to actually the nature of our own heart. There's a story that Bodhidharma spent a number of years sitting in a cave in deep meditation in the snowy mountains. And one day, another seeker, another monk came, a man called Ekka, who would eventually become the successor to Bodhidharma. But at this time, he was just somebody who was still seeking, someone who was still seeking spiritual fulfillment. And he had heard of Bodhidharma and had finally tracked him down. And we can assume that Ekka had already been involved in a spiritual practice for quite some time in order even to get this far, because in the snowy mountains, it wasn't easy. He must have had terrific determination in order even just to get this far. And standing outside, he called to Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma simply ignored him. And Ekka presumed correctly that Bodhidharma was testing him to see how much strength he already had. And so he remained standing outside the cave all night, and the snow fell. And by the morning, it came up to his knees. And Bodhidharma, taking pity on him, taking compassion on him, turned and said, "What is it that you've come for?" And Ekka replied, "I have come for the Dharma." And Bodhidharma sort of went, "Puh." He said, "You, with your little strength, with your little power, you come here asking for that which the old masters ground their bones into dust for?" And with that, Ekka took out his knife and cut off his right arm and presented it to Bodhidharma. I see people grinning around as they hear that, thinking, "Oh my God, is this what we're going to have to do?" A pile of right arms outside before the end of the week. In fact, when it comes to it, we may wish that that's all we had to give. No one's actually going to ask for your right arm. But this practice will ask for everything. In the end, it will ask for everything that I am to be laid down. And this, perhaps, is the way we can read that particular incident. Bodhidharma turned to Ekka and said, "So, what is it that you want?" And Ekka said, "My heart, it's my heart, it's not at peace. Please, can you put at peace my restless heart?" And Bodhidharma said to him, "Show me this restless heart, and I will pacify it for you." Now, presumably, Ekka went away at this point and did as he had been asked. He looked for this heart that was ever restless, so that he could bring it to Bodhidharma. And after a certain passage of time, he came back and said to Bodhidharma, "I cannot find it." And Bodhidharma said, "There, your heart is now at rest." Now that "I cannot find it" actually meant that Ekka had already realized that this heart, the nature of this heart, is that it has no nature of its own whatsoever. In other words, the natural nature of this heart is not male or female. It's not Ekka or Bodhidharma. It is emptiness. It is quite empty. And here we are back at this empty heart which Venerable Sogan was talking of last night. And the beauty of this empty heart is not, please, that it's, as it's sometimes erroneously translated, the void, but that, as he also said, it can become anything. This empty heart, having no form or structure of its own, can become every form or structure. It can apply itself to all circumstances, and therefore it is not restricted. If we remember the story of the Buddha when he was born, and it's said, according to the tradition, that having emerged from his mother's right side, that infant child took 7 steps in each of the 4 directions, north, south, west, and east, raised one hand to heaven, one hand to earth, and declared, "Between heaven and earth, I alone am the world-honoured one." Which seems quite a remarkable thing for a newborn child to actually declare. But what does this actually point to now? Because we know that these miraculous births are not to be taken literally. It's symbolic. It's pointing to something. What is this going north, south, east, and west? This north, south, east, and west, this, what is the baby Buddha? This baby Buddha is the newly born spiritual heart. It's the heart that realizes, that has just realized, that it has that reflective capability, that ability to be able to see things as they really are, just for a moment before they become obscured, as just before the delusion of I that has been inherited from traditionally time immemorial now begins to cover it over and obscure it and cloud it. And that heart, which is empty, because it doesn't seek to defend anything, because it is not anything, has nothing to fear. Because we can only fear loss. We can only fear something being taken away. The more I want something, the more attached I am to something, the more frightened I am that I will lose it. If there's no more attachment, if there's nothing to lose, no attachment to anything anymore, then what is there to be frightened of? And so because of that, that child can move in every direction, north, south, east, west, up, down, this, that way. Can we do the same? Oh yes, I'm quite free. We live in a reasonably free country. If I want to get on the train and go to Manchester or Glasgow or take a boat out to the Hebrides, I can do so if I've got the cash to do so. This isn't the freedom to go north, south, east and west. Because then I start going on my journey. I get on my train to go to Manchester and I sit down, and I'm quite a sort of large bloke, and I sit in the chair and I put my bag on the seat next to me like this, and people start getting on the train. And I start looking and thinking, you know, it's a long trip, it's 2 hours to Manchester from London. I can do without somebody squashing me in the seat next to, which is why I have my bag there, and I stare out of the window like this. And then finally somebody stands there, you know, looking at me, and I hope that if I just carry on looking out of the window, they'll go away. And they say, "Excuse me, would you mind moving your bag so that I may sit down, please?" And then rather guiltily I put it underneath there, and the person sits down, and that person also happens to be of quite an ample stature as well, and now I'm like this. And I have my Kindle like this, but I can't read it because I'm furious. Am I free? Am I free? Or is it that I am still so hung up on having my space around me so that I can now relax on this train journey, which I quite enjoy train journeys, in fact. This is the imprisoning effect of I. This is the imprisoning effect of the passions. They come and carry me away. And we're not able to respond freely to those circumstances. This is why that child is between heaven and earth, the world honoured one. And this is why that heart, actually the thing about the heart itself is that its natural state is that liberated, free state that can adapt to circumstances. But because I have no trust in that emptiness, in that empty heart, what do I trust? Myself, that's what I trust. I've got to solve this problem. I've got to have my own way, otherwise I cannot be happy. Unless I get X, Y, or Z, unless I attain nirvana and enlightenment, unless I am in such and such a circumstances, I cannot be happy. And I believe it. I absolutely believe it. And this is in complete denial to the power and the emptiness of that heart, which actually can go with all circumstances, if it's allowed to, just as long as I don't keep getting in the way. Can we now begin to see the importance of that reverence and that faith and having to overcome that feeling of, but I won't or I can't? Because what is this I? Is it something actually? No, it's not. I is just the thought of I. Every time I think I won't, every time I think I can't and I'm frightened, that is I. It's nothing else. In the absence of the thought of I, there is nothing. There's nothing there. In the absence of the thought of I, there is no I. Show me this restless heart and I will pacify it for you. In other words, if you can bring this I to me, then we'll get rid of it. But of course, it was when he realized, not just intellectually, please, but actually realized in his own heart that his heart fundamentally was empty. That the true nature of I is not even that there's an I to get rid of. How can we get rid of a delusion? There never has been an I to get rid of. It's impossible. It's just to realize the nature of the heart as it is. How much more he who turns within and confirms directly his own nature, that his own nature is no nature, such has transcended vain words. The gate opens and cause and effect are one. The gate opens. A gate, it demarks, it's a boundary, a gate, like a doorway. It marks two places, inside and outside, or here and there. And actually points to that basic duality, I and other. Because isn't that how I feel when self-conscious? There I am invited to a party. I only know the host. So I go along and the host is sort of wandering around filling, serving drinks and offering hors d'oeuvres and things. And I know nobody else. And everybody else seems to know each other and they're all huddled in little groups. And I'm sort of in the corner on my own with a sort of plate and a glass like this. And I feel really self-conscious. And it's me and them and I don't know what to say. And this is ridiculous. I mean, for goodness sake, Martin, you know, you're normally a reasonably articulate person. Just go and talk to somebody. But I don't feel comfortable about it. There is that real sense of a barrier. There's that real sense of a barrier. Not being able to go. And if I go and force myself, well, if I give myself into it, actually may find quite quickly that it is possible in joining. But interestingly, if that feeling of self-consciousness, like if I'm particularly shy or particularly nervous for some particular reason, then I try and force it. If I'm not hiding myself away in the corner thinking that I'm too big for my own skin, then I might go and I in mind fear and nerves, I chat, 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 and my nerves may come out that way. And this is often the way with I. It either overdoes it or underdoes it. The gate opens. And every so often, as well, another situation where that feeling of I is exacerbated, of course, is when we are in pain and when we're suffering. When something happens to us that throws us. Most of the time, remember the story about the Buddha Prince Gautama living in the palace, living in the sort of luxurious palace that his father set up for him, and he never went outside. He was forbidden to go outside. Actually, we spend a lot of our time living in such palaces. Maybe not quite as grand as a prince, but in our own way, we do live a sort of our own particular royal life. We have around us all the things that make us feel comfortable and myself, and it's very subtle. You know, there's my room and how I like my things and how I like things to be done and my routine and my work and my friends and so forth. And there's all those nice things that sort of make me feel comfortable. In fact, it's often called my comfort zone, really. And then every so often, something comes along that suddenly bursts that bubble. It might be that I go home and the love of my life tells me they've found somebody else and they're going off with them. It might be that I go into work after a week on a Buddhist summer school feeling now completely together and rested and thinking that I can face everything life has, and I'm called in and my boss calls me in and says, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. Or that I have to go to the doctor for a routine examination, and he says, I'm afraid, Martin, we've got very bad news for you. And suddenly, those things that seemed so comfortable and so normal that I never even thought about them, just took them so for granted, suddenly they all appear a little bit alien now. They no longer comfort me anymore. And again, I remember Venerable Myokini telling an anecdote that she knew somebody from her time in the 50s in London who was a member of the Buddhist group who was going through a particularly difficult time. And he was a Londoner born and bred. And he said that whenever he was a boy, the one thing he really loved was that his dad would take him to Battersea Park and would buy him an ice cream. And he said, you know, he would stand there licking this ice cream and he always felt really on top of the world, you know. And so he thought maybe that would cheer him up now as an adult. So he went to Battersea Park and he bought an ice cream and he stood there licking this ice cream. It's a terrible situation, really, because, of course, when we are suffering and in pain like that and somebody comes along and says, well, I know how you feel. And the first response is, no, you don't know how I feel. Because actually, the most overpowering or underpinning sense of that emotion is actually that I am cut off from you. I am isolated. I am separated. And perhaps that feeling of separation, of isolation, is in particular the mark of the delusion of I. That's how we know that the delusion of I has invaded consciousness and is just now here. Because somehow I feel cut off, that feeling of separation. Now perhaps we can see why our practice is to give myself away into what at this moment is being done. Because with that giving of myself, suddenly there is coming into the relationship. There is a communality with things. There is a oneness that arises that has a specific name, samadhi. We'll be looking at that a little bit more tomorrow. And out of that samadhi, there comes that reciprocity as well. I look at the flower, and the flower looks at me. The gate opens, and cause and effect are one. Straight runs the way, not two, not three. There's a saying, when sitting, sit, when standing, stand, but above all, don't wobble. Straight runs the way, not two, not three. A wholehearted action is straightforward. It doesn't have that hesitation in it. One of the slightly more, let's say, interesting things that we've done previously at our retreats that we used to do, haven't done it for a while, is we used to have this exercise of queuing up to open and close a door. We would all file through a door, and one by one we would open and close it. And the idea was to just give ourselves wholeheartedly into opening it, walking through and closing the door. And my goodness, how difficult it is, particularly when people are watching, because we do a number of different things. One thing is, for example, is that people would sort of walk up to the door and the door would be there. And normally if you walk up, you walk right up to the door, you know, you'd open it and say, push it that way and then walk through. Or maybe open it and pull it this way and then walk through. And one thing would be that people would stand too far away. So you stand too far away, then you have to reach out like this, grab the handle, bent, and then pull. And it just looks really awkward. We wouldn't normally do that, but it's the self-consciousness that does that, because there's a little part of me that doesn't want to get it wrong, because I don't like getting it wrong. I don't like being told off, or I don't like being corrected. I don't like not getting it right. So that would be one thing. And then having got through the door and then on the other side, closing it again, and I'd be closing it. And then just before I've let the handle come up and let go, I've turned the body away and I'm already walking away. In other words, I'm not wholeheartedly, just that last little bit, I don't want to stay with it. I'm already thinking about the next thing, which is, it just reveals those little things that actually come along. And that opening and closing the door. And sometimes with people, again, it's like with the bowing yesterday, we can open the door and go through and then close the door. And then it's like both hands like this, and it's sort of, you know, as if they were sort of, I don't know, diffusing a nuclear bomb like this. And you know, if the red wire touches the green wire, then we're all blown to oblivion. This is the last little bit. It always goes bang, like that. Like that, and it always jumps. And it's very, very difficult when that self-consciousness has grabbed us like that to be able to let go with that. And it's just, it brings it out, rather like the timetable, it just brings it out so that it can be seen and it can be worked with a little bit. We can open up to it a little bit and give it house room. And then we find that it does go just that little bit more smoothly. But that, it's fear. That's what self-consciousness is. It's just fear. It's, I'm not quite going to give myself to it. I'm just holding those three coins back because I'm frightened what it actually might mean. And this is what it means. Straight runs the way. Straight runs the way. Not two, not three. There isn't two of us in closing a door. There is not two of us, not even one, actually. There's no one there, just the door closing. We'll look at that a little bit more tomorrow. Taking as form the form of no form. We've talked a little bit about the form already. Going or returning, he is ever at home. Between heaven and earth, those seven steps in the four directions. Not feeling that in one place this is home, this is comfort zone, and out there, frightened of going out there, what may be there. When the heart truly is empty, then everywhere is home. That was the answer that was given to Laurens van der Post by the Bushmen, who, because they used to be nomadic, but he said, don't you ever miss having your own home? And he said, wherever we go, the country always makes us at home. And he really felt that. Taking as thought the thought of no thought. These thoughts that arise, actually, they're not a problem. They're just as they are. If a thought is seen as a thought, well, it's like seeing the bottle as a bottle and the glass as a glass. It's just phenomena. No need to get rid of anything, not even a thought. But not to be carried away by it either. And that's the middle way. Singing and dancing, all is the voice of truth, which is another, really just another way of saying between heaven and earth, I alone and the world honoured one. This I is not I, it's this empty heart, which is something quite different. We'll leave it.